listening to Kent Biz Connect, the show that connects businesses in Kent to do business. Tweet us live at Kent_biz.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, and thank you so much for tuning in to the bi-weekly Kent Biz Connect radio show with myself, Martin White.
And me, Brian Wakefield.
Brian, great to see you.
And you, matey, and you.
We've got a couple of fabulous studio guests with us today, one of whom is smiling intently at me. Please introduce yourselves, guys.
Hi there, I'm Ali Hollands. I'm a clinical hypnotherapist from Inspired to Change and a clinical hypnotherapy tutor.
Welcome to the show, Ali.
Thanks.
And I'm fabulous guest number two. I'm David DiCara. I'm a Toastmaster and Master of Ceremonies.
Dave, welcome to the show
Thank you, guys.
And we look forward to hearing from you in depth as we move through the agenda of the show today, Brian, which is what exactly? What are we here to do?
Well, we normally have a catch-up. What's been going on? We normally talk about rubbish in Margate at the weekend. Was there any rubbish in Margate this weekend?
Margate hasn't hit the news this week for all the wrong reasons, no. But there is some other interesting news that we're going to kind of talk about.
Yeah.
You can tweet us as well. Our Twitter is at Kent_biz if you would like us to give you a shout-out live on the show today. We also have a fabulous website where you'll probably tuned in from at the moment, kenbizconnect.co.uk. But if you're not, you can actually listen back to the show in our episode section, and the show today will be live on there from tomorrow morning. But without further ado, Brian, why don't you kick us off with some fantastic, exciting Kent business news that's happening locally?
I can't guarantee any of it's exciting, but the news is the news, isn't it? It's happening in Kent, and that's the main thing. So, two or three things caught my eye. Do you know that Capel Le Fern, which is a nice little village between Dover and Folkestone? And apparently there's a nice pub there called the Lighthouse Inn, which is quite famous. Anybody ever been there? Do you know it, Dave?
Yeah, from a long time ago.
Okay, yeah, the pictures of it look nice. Well, apparently it mysteriously closed down in July.
Mysteriously?
What,
under mysterious circumstances?
Exactly that, because nobody knew why.
Right.
Why it closed or anything. All they could cite was a dispute with the landlord, which could mean anything. But apparently it's now up for sale for £500,000.
Ooh.
So that may well be open. So residents of Capel Le Fern and other such places, you may well have a pub to go to again.
It's an interesting area, that, isn't it, Dave? Because they've got the Spitfire Museum up there as well, I think, haven't they? Or Battle of Britain Memorial Museum or something up there, haven't they?
I think it's a bit of a gem that's easy to go past completely when you go down that road.
Mm.
You have to turn off to get to it, don't you?
You absolutely do. Hey, guys, we've got some wonderful TV going on here in this radio studio.
But you're right, it's well worth a visit. They've got a mock Spitfire and a mock Hurricane in the grounds of the memorial site there as well. And it used to be actually an airfield, didn't it, on the top of the cliff there. So they would actually fly across the channel and, dogfight and everything. So it's well worth the trip. But anyway, Brian, thank you for that. So
why Martin is our East Kent expert. He knows all this stuff.
Look forward to the pub reopening.
Yeah, exactly. Another little bit of East Kent and something that you'll also be an expert on, Martin. I hear this morning that Eurotunnel pledge and guarantee that they are ready for a no-deal Brexit. Ooh. So there will be no hold-ups at all. Everything will go swimmingly.
Fabulous.
As if it didn't happen, basically. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So if you're thinking of travelling by, Eurotunnel after the 1st of November, mm-hmm. you need not worry anymore because it's all fine, apparently.
Is that how you're going to get to Cyprus then? Because I know you're travelling to Cyprus just after then, aren't you?
I am, on the 3rd of November,
on the 3rd,
actually.
Right.
Yeah. So
so have you built that kind of that extra journey time in? Have you sort of travelling by car via the Eurotunnel, or are you still hoping to fly?
Well, I certainly had to renew my passport earlier than I thought I was going to have to. So because it ran out in next May or something like that. That's not good enough now. So because I'm going in November, I did have to renew it early. So I've got a nice shiny new passport.
I think, I don't know about you guys, but that sounds to me like the first bit of positive news I've heard around a no-deal Brexit, with a kind of a large organisation like Eurotunnel, a large business coming out and openly saying, do you know what? Brexit or no Brexit deal.
It
doesn't make any difference to us. It's business as usual.
I thought what that meant was that they've hired in the trolley carts to come along with water for the queues that are going to happen. I thought that's what they meant.
I'm with you, Dave.
This is we're having a positive show today.
It's a bold statement.
It is a bold statement.
Them, but they've made it now.
Yes. Mm. So people will hold them to account on that basis. But
can we do to them if it isn't then?
Well, I don't know. I mean,
sell them to the French.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, don't the French own them already?
I think it's. I'm not sure who owns it now. Actually, I think it's probably. I don't know. I've no idea. I think you're right. It probably is French. I know SNCF certainly used to have a big chunk of it. But anyway, what a positive statement to come out with.
Yeah,
so no deal Brexit. It's business as usual and we're not going to be affected. So well done, Eurotunnel.
Yeah, it is.
Let's hope you don't end up with oof on your face at the end of that.
Do you have any of those like little noises that you can do? Budum-tsh. Like that would have been really good. Right
like
then.
An egg falling on the floor or something.
Yes.
No, we probably have somewhere, but
that's actually very funny for you, Martin. That's the funniest I've ever known you been in all the years I've known you.
I'm just practicing for my holiday later in the week. I've got to get some vocabulary.
Where are you going?
I do like oof on toast.
Where are you going? Germany?
Exactly. Yeah, Dutch. Right.
We've got another positive little snippet, actually. So a company called Priory Direct, who are a packaging supplier in Aylesford, which is literally around the corner from me, they've just secured £50,000 worth of new orders from new customers in Holland.
Ooh.
So, again, this kind of stuff where people are thinking we're just not going to be able to do business. They've just done it. They supply labels, packaging, warehouse supplies and stuff like that. They were helped immensely by DIT, which is the Department for International Trade, that kind of showed them really probably a few shortcuts and stuff like that. So I think that's a bit of good news. So
fabulous.
If people, again, also are uncertain about how things are going to happen, the Department for International Trade seem to be worth a conversation with. Now, here's the biggest thing, and this is a bit of a local story, really. So here we are broadcasting from Ashford. There's a huge redevelopment planned of Ashford Railway Works. So I don't know if you've kind of familiar with that or you know of it, but basically it was all built back in 1847 to serve the London to Dover Railway. It was kind of heavily bombed, really, during the Second World War, and then basically most of the buildings were derelict until about 1962. It was all moved to Eastleigh in Hampshire, and they've just been kind of demolished since. They're actually talking about Netflix and Amazon getting hold of it and building three or four film and TV studios. There's also going to be, they describe it as a full ecosystem of film-related creative businesses. And I think it was going to kind of sail through. But like,
because that industry has changed massively, hasn't it?
So
it used to be the case where you would have to go on location to kind of, to film anything, to make it look kind of real life. You know, we are actually here and therefore it is, where we say it is.
But because of the technology and what they can do, you probably don't actually have to go anywhere.
They shoot so much of it, don't they, against like a green background. And then they sort of, they computer comp the rest of it in, which is quite remarkable. I was watching a film by Ridley Scott last week,
Queens?
No. Oh, God, I can't remember the name of it, but it was the story of Moses and the Egyptian pharaoh at the time. I think it was Ramesses or somebody like that, if I get my ancient history right. And but they'd filmed a big chunk of it, the scene where he parts the Red Sea, where God parts the Red Sea so that Moses can escape with the slaves across the Red Sea, from the pharaoh who's chasing them down. And they filmed that in Fuerteventura because I've actually been to that beach. It's a devil to get to. You need a sort of an off-road car, and then you drive down this track, and it is literally as it is on the film, with the road falling away and what have you. But then a lot of it I didn't quite recognise, because, of course, it had all been comped in, you know, in the studio afterwards, and that's what that's all about, isn't it? I think it is.
They're looking for the next step with technology and to take Newtown to next development. However, it is under a little bit of scrutiny now, because I guess these things have got to be paid for. There needs to be a commercial element to it. So it's kind of come out that there are five Grade 2 listed buildings there already, which, of course, they won't be able to do very much to. Mm. But as part of the development, there's going to be 300 apartments included in it, and a 180-bedroom hotel, so which I guess would pretty much make it the biggest hotel in Ashford, in the area, possibly. Yeah. I don't know.
On a par with the Ashford International, I think, certainly.
Yeah, because that's going to be about that, isn't it? 180-odd bedrooms, yes. Perhaps.
We'll have to ask Lynette, but I'm sure it's about that kind of size.
It's there or thereabout. Mm. So it's an interesting twist, I think. So this is in the Newtown area of Ashford, and it's going to be a huge development, clearly, by looking at the size of that. Yes, you know, can't make omelets without breaking a few eggs, so there's going to be an element of disruption and stuff like that. But there's a consultation going on at the Railway Club, of course, in Beaver Road this Wednesday between 4 and 7. So people should really get down there if they've got some concerns, views. But what do we think about that? Is that generally a good thing for Ashford, do you think? Mm. So new houses, new businesses.
I kind of think that Ashford's in that situation where anything new is going to be useful.
Yeah.
I don't live close by Ashford, but I've been around there for quite a long time. I think this kind of news is actually delightful. It's a very, very good centre geographically. You mentioned those TV studios, you mentioned those streaming businesses as well. I think it's going to be very, very good business indeed if they can get in there. Mm. And there's a lot of character to those works. I mean, you know, you're talking about the special effects. There's an awful lot of films that you can make around railways and around the old kind of buildings that they've got down there.
But isn't it exciting that they're able to sort of, you know, that the kind of the modern world we live in, that people are kind of, you know, often a little bit critical of, you know, because it's kind of technology and it's all new things that people don't necessarily understand 100%. But isn't it nice to see something like as old as that being repurposed with, you know, a brand new, you know, film industry or, TV industry, you know, wanting to kind of site their European headquarters there. I mean, it's a bit like Battersea Power Station, you know, stood empty for years and years. I mean, just embarrassing, really, to have a huge site like that just standing empty because nobody was prepared to kind of take it on. And now I think that's going to be a massive new business park. Mm. I think Apple are going to move their UK headquarters in there. And, you know, so finally that's happening as well. They're going to keep the kind of the outside fabric, but it'll be, you know, all new business and all new industry kind of driving it commercially inside.
As you say, it's decades. It's just been empty there, really.
Yeah. That's got to be a good thing, hasn't it? Maybe he likes to look at an eyesore kind of standing there. Emptied.
Lands at a premium, you can't make any more.
Yeah, it's the same with like the Folkestone Harbour Arm.
Right.
The works that they've been doing there, and actually thinking the same thing with Ashford, is actually the work that they've done is it's beautifully working in context, and they've kept a lot of it, and they've done sort of art and kept the history of it. And actually, it's a lot of stuff that none of us ever knew what was going on there. But actually, so it's re-enlivened the history of the area, as well as bringing industry, bringing culture, bringing a lot of people to Folkestone, which, of course, they have to go through every other bit of Folkestone to get to.
Yeah,
so, of course, it was a really good idea. Mm. And for the people that organised and instigated that, I don't know where they've moved on to, but there's another area that they're now working on. So they go, right, that worked brilliantly. Yep, there was plenty of scope there, people loved it. I mean, you can see the commercial value in it. And then they're moving on. So I'm guessing that Ashford, they're thinking, yeah, we'd like a bit of that, actually. Look, we do have these Grade 2 listed buildings that we're going to use the people who are going to build a hotel and flats to finance, making them beautiful and keeping it in context, because that's what we do in the UK, whilst bringing some really interesting and modern business to it.
That's a really good point, because, you know, the economic team at Ashford, One Ashford, so it's the regeneration team, Andrew Osborne and his team there have worked wonders in Ashford over the past few years, and Curious Brew, which is just kind of opened, you know, new brewery, you know, that's fabulous as well. But you're absolutely right, Ali. What's happened is, I think in this instance, it's a developer, isn't it? It's Quinn Estates.
It's Quinn Estates, yes.
So a fairly large local developer are kind of driving this agenda on a kind of from a commercial perspective, because that's what it needs. Because without that private sector money coming in, a lot of these projects just don't get off the ground.
They've not got the backing. They need somebody who can view it with, you know, pound signs attached to it, and people, so maybe like the Railway Club, going, that's great. Here are the things that we need in there to make it okay. And when those two work together, I think it works beautifully.
But your example of Folkestone is a really good case, Annie, because, of course, a lot of that has been driven by the Dehaan Trust. So Roger Dehaan, you know, and the money that he's been able to put in through his trust, having, you know, sold his saga business and what have you. But again, without that, a lot of that just simply wouldn't have happened. So,
but all of that needs people with vision. I lived in Folkestone. For a while, and you know, if you look at you look back at what the harbour arm actually used to look like before anybody started doing some work on it, what a decrepit looking area! Absolutely,
since they stopped using the railway, wasn't it?
Yeah,
absolutely.
The railway, you know, that whole bit of real estate there just completely gone to waste. Somebody's had the vision to create something that we see there now, and they've done beautiful work on the railway line, introducing that back into the harbour itself, and the walkways they've created. It's a fantastic place.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
And the old waiting rooms, there's Prosecco bars and
doesn't hurt, does it? And cracking pizza.
But I think you're right, Ali, and I think it is going round the coast, and I think the seaside towns in particular, I mean, we started to see it with Margate, you know, with the gallery there, obviously, you know, the Turner Contemporary. We were talking about Ramsgate. And under the arches there, and the little restaurants and bars that are springing up directly opposite the harbour, which is beautiful. So I think it's gradually starting to happen, certainly in sort of traditionally quite deprived areas dotted around the coast. So it's a really good thing, but Ashford, I think, has always been earmarked as a kind of a potential.
It's ready for that next.
Well,
step,
it's the kind of the metropolis, isn't it, that the government always kind of thought it would be, starting to kind of materialise in a big way.
What's that I say? The saying, Ashford is an up and coming place. It's been up and coming for decades.
Exactly.
And it's lovely to see the something on this
really
kind
happening.
Of scale really happening now.
Very positive. Brian, gosh, what a positive bit of news.
Yeah, loads of news there.
And of course, to top it all off, the Railway Club, who are opening their doors for this public consultation. Imagine the beer they're going to sell.
Yeah, I know.
You know, they probably do about 10 pints a week, you know, with the old kind of members that always go along. But this week, crikey, I hope they get a couple of kegs in. They'll be booming, won't they?
It'll still be 2 and 6 for half a bitter, I should think.
I used to go to ballroom dancing lessons in the Railway Club.
Did you?
Yeah.
Fabulous.
Years ago.
Wow. Did they work, by the way?
I wasn't very good.
No. Well, isn't it all very positive today? I'm liking this. Yeah, no negativity at all. So what a lovely show.
We haven't mentioned traffic and we've mentioned Brexit in a semi-positive
way. Well, only in a positive way. Yeah. Good, right. Brian, it's nearly 25 past 3.
Is it really?
Do you think we should play some music by way of an introduction to our first guest?
A little bit of tunage.
A bit of tunage?
Why not?
Right,
yes.
Okay. So without further ado...
I like this bit.
That's what we're going to do, and we'll see you on the other side. I can do what to do after all you put me through. Tell us more.
Tell me more. Yeah, I'll tell you what, that was a blast in the past, that. That was a group called Mud. And better known for things like Tiger Feet and stuff like that. But that's one of their lesser known ones. That was Hypnosis by Les Graham Mudd. But nevertheless, back to the 70s. And a song called Hypnosis. Oh, so
fabulous.
I thought that was a great, great lead-in to the wonderful Ali Hollands.
I'm just amazed because I never knew that song existed. So
well, it's a bit before your time, Ali.
My day's made.
You're going to use it all the time now, aren't you? That's going to be your song.
That's the theme tune. I want to write the theme tune and play the theme tune.
Absolutely. You wait. Next time you hear my phone going, it will be that instead of Pharrell.
Welcome to the show, Ali Hollands.
Thank you very much.
Clinical hypnotherapist.
Yes.
But also, more importantly, teacher of clinical hypnotherapy to people who would like to become accredited and certified therapists themselves.
Absolutely, yes. It was a few years ago now. I've been qualified since 2012, and a few years ago I retrained again, so I got my third hypnotherapy qualification. And after that, someone asked me, would I like to teach it? And actually, yes. Mostly because I think there's a real need for more people that do what we do, because it's a really powerful therapy. And I always say to people, we're moving away from, you know, once upon a time we would have been called an alternate therapy. Now we're called a complementary therapy. So we work alongside the medical profession, and we're a support for mainstream medical. And so, of course, you need people trained to that level, mm-hmm. where it's, you know, can talk to doctors, can talk to other therapists, can be part of a care team. We work in the mental health sector as well as, you know, well, in the health sector, really. Mm. It's not particularly well-being. It's actually health most of the time.
So, for example, I mean, I've just been to my GP recently because I've got a problem with my knee, and they've referred me into a specialist physiotherapy unit within the practice. In the same way, I could have gone to my GP and said, I have a problem with sleeping, or I have a problem with eating or smoking or whatever.
Soon, Martin, soon.
Wait.
We are moving. It's amazing. We are moving in that direction. Mm-hmm. And that's the other reason why we need to have more people trained in a way that doctors and GPs and hospitals can, with confidence, refer people. And you can only do that when they can look at our qualifications and understand what that means, because of course there are hundreds of different schools. You could actually, because we're still self-regulated, you could call yourself a hypnotherapist right now.
Right.
And no one could stop you. Mm-hmm. So we're in the self-regulation. I would say we're kind of where chiropractic and physio were maybe 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. We're in that kind of just crossover phase.
Right.
Where people are starting to go, oh yeah, you'd just go and see them, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
We're not quite there yet. Okay. We are still a little bit end of the road. Mm. But
so GPs can't yet refer.
But they are allowed to say hypnotherapy is
have
a valid
you tried?
Thing. Mm. Have you tried hypnotherapy? Mm. They can't. We can't be prescribed.
Right.
But they can, and they actually have done for decades. Mm. Been encouraged to say hypnotherapy is one way of moving of getting out of this stuff. And of course, they're getting less resistance to it and less resistant to it because their hands are tied a lot of the time. They're hamstrung and they've got a limited amount of time with someone.
Mm.
And actually they're looking for someone who they can trust to be able to say, actually, this is a really valid route.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the more that we are regulated, the more that we show ourselves to be part of that support of the profession, the easier it can be. We're not there to replace them. Mm. We're there to work in concert.
Mm. Brilliant. Fantastic. So when it comes to working and training people to be hypnotherapists, what are some of the kind of the core skills that they need as individuals? What do you look for in someone that comes to you and says, I'd like to do this as a profession? What are the things that kind of stand out for you that you think, yes, you'd make a brilliant hypnotherapist?
So thinking of the people that I've taught and trained with, who I thought are absolutely brilliant, the first thing is you've got to want to help.
Mm.
You've got to be really excited by that. You can't think of this as a business first and then therapy after. You have to think of it as, I would like to help people. Quite often, people have gone through their own journey, for want of a better word, not my favourite, you know, but they've kind of got some life experience which has led them to be a little bit more open or a little bit more compassionate than maybe if nothing had ever gone wrong in life.
Mm.
So they're aware of either, you know, counselling or therapy or any of the other hundreds of ways that we find to make ourselves feel okay.
Mm.
So there's a little bit, there's compassion and there's a desire to help.
Mm.
And also you have to be someone who gets excited by doing something like this. You know, there has to be a genuine joy in seeing someone get better and move on with their life.
Mm-hmm. Which kind of fits into the whole ethos of the NHS, doesn't it? People that go and work for the NHS, that's really why they do it,
isn't
it?
So,
absolutely.
And so by kind of encouraging people like that into what you do as a profession, then, you know, moving forwards, that should again just kind of help smooth the path into kind of more mainstream, it becoming a mainstream treatment.
Absolutely. And we have, you know, so your previous guest, Claire, who from Inspire to Change 2, she's a pharmacist. I have lots of nurses who come and train with me. At the moment in Birmingham, we've got the head of the psychology for the prisons in Birmingham training with us. That wasn't at all intimidating to go and teach. Oh, yeah, I was like, on my absolute best behavior that day. But that's kind of who we teach now. And people who are, you know, just for want of it, just like you and me, you know, who had no previous experience whatsoever but have a desire to help and have a curiosity about how we work.
How does it work on a kind of
magic
on a training
sorry.
I mean not hypnosis but on a kind of on a training level. You know, is there a kind of a curriculum that you follow
Absolutely.
With an individual? And is it done on an individual basis or can you
no,
do it in a group?
No, it's better. I would say group learning's better because this is a people thing. So you have to get good with people. You have to work with people. It's very practical. I can't talk about anyone else's, but I will talk about ours. So ours is over 10 months. And it's we meet for one weekend a month. And then in between, they have to practice with their own clients.
Mm-hmm.
So those clients might just be at the beginning. They'll just be relaxation. So there's no therapy. But by the time they've reached month 6, 7, 8, 9, they are seeing people that I would see, mm-hmm. genuinely. So mm-hmm. they're doing genuine, valuable therapy. Mm-hmm. So we do, obviously, the academic stuff in with us. So we talk about how the brain works, you know, different issues that people have. So we will talk about what is PTSD, what is OCD, you know, the neuroscience of weight management, you know, talking about what happens in the brain when, you know, when we have nicotine in the brain, things like that. So we talk about that mm-hmm. and how to do the therapy so that they can go out and practice. Because again, you need to have that support from people who do it. And all our people are still practicing therapists. You know, it's one of our kind of our stipulations is you have to still be in practice. You have to know what's going on. Yeah, so we meet and we work together for a couple of days and we'll do some practical stuff and we'll do some theoretical stuff. I'll make their brains hurt talking about neuroscience and then they will go out and practice in between. Mm. And there's a whole portfolio, so a written side of it that goes underneath. Obviously, I always say it's competency-based, so that side of it, people go, oh, is there an exam? It's like, no, it's like an NVQ.
Right.
So it's this is what I know, mm-hmm. this is what I understand. Mm-hmm. So, and it's all with the desire for them to go into practice. So it's not theoretical. Mm-hmm. It's with a always with a practical application. I warn people. I say, you're going to get bored of me saying, and when you're in practice, this is what that means. Mm. So, yeah.
And is there a formal qualification at the end of those 12 months? So what is that actually called?
You get a certificate.
You do. You get two, actually, if you do really well. So the first one comes from Clifton Practice Hypnotherapy Training, which is our kind of our internal qualification. Mm. So we verify that, and that's a diploma in solution-focused hypnotherapy. That still enables you to join all the really well-respected associations and get insurance and things like that, and your DBS.
Right.
But externally verified, which I think is the one that's the reason we need to do it, because that's the direction which we're going, is an HPD. So that would be a hypnotherapy practitioner diploma. Mm. So that's through the NCFE. It's an award through the NCFE, mm-hmm. and it's a level 4 on the Ofqual framework. So if you think, I would say, when people say, what does that mean? Was that my daughter is going to come out in 2 years with a level 3 from college, and you'll come out in 10 months with a level 4 from this.
Right.
Okay. So it's a very good professional mm-hmm. Award.
Through a process of continuous assessment?
Yeah.
Through yourselves over the 12 months?
Yes, and giving a portfolio that we assess first, but then it also gets externally verified as well.
Right.
So
I mean, there's quite a commitment there, isn't there?
Yes.
If that's what you want to do to help people, you know, there is a 12-month commitment to actually understanding it properly and being able to be credible when you go out into the marketplace and practice.
Absolutely.
Which is important, because you were saying earlier on, you know, it's not a case of, you know, somebody can just turn up or decide one day that they want to be a hypnotherapist, go to a business networking group, for example, and actually start to talk about the fact that they are a hypnotherapist.
Well, yeah, the terrifying thing is that technically they can.
Or do they?
Yeah.
Because is it like a light bulb moment that you just think, that's what I want to do?
No, that's where the people that we wouldn't want on the course do.
Because
I've
seen
the
light.
I mean, it's great wanting to do it, but wanting to do it and being able to do it are two different things. And there's a difference between being able to do hypnosis and doing clinical hypnotherapy. And I think that's the thing that sometimes, you know, it's like, it's easy. I could teach you in 5 minutes how to do hypnosis.
Right.
It's not the most difficult thing in the world.
Mm-hmm. But I won't be able to cure anybody of anything.
Yeah, no, and it's just like, well, that's fun, but now what?
Yes.
And it's the therapeutic model that's the important bit. And it's the therapeutic model that doctors and nurses and clinicians are interested in, because, you know, it's the Royal College of Nursing. When I went and watched a talk there, it was like, we talk about it in a way that there's a model of therapy with trance as an adjunct. So it's like, you need to know your stuff, plus we use trance because all change does happen at the neurological level.
So if I do meet somebody who talks to me in those terms, I really should be asking them if they have a diploma. Do they have a formal diploma that they can kind of, that will demonstrate to me the fact that they've gone through this process with somebody like yourselves to actually get properly qualified and accredited?
Yeah. Mm. I mean, I think there's a presumption that we have. I've probably only been asked three times.
Right.
In however many years it is now. Mm. But, yeah, I think we should be going in that direction. Mm. You know, there's a reason we have our, you know, our certificates up so that people can see that, you know, it is valid. And I think the more people understand it, the more they'll know what those certificates mean. Because, of course, sometimes they can mean nothing.
Yeah. Well, when you go and see your GP, they have a code of practice, don't they? You know, they're not able to disclose any personal information about you, you know, outside of those four walls.
Absolutely.
And, you know, if I was coming to somebody like you because I had a particular problem that I wanted you to help me with, again, I would want that reassurance that it was going to go no further. And that, for me, is that kind of stamp of credibility.
So. Absolutely. And that's our job all the time, is to allow people to feel safe. Mm. And that's, so, again, that's part of what I teach people is, you know, how to create that environment. You know, what should you have in practice? Some people say, oh, you know, it's like someone, he said, oh, I got an inquiry. So I asked them straight away, do you want to jump on a Skype call? And I went, there's a reason they didn't take you up on that. And, you know, people with anxiety won't do that. Mm. That's not how they work. Mm. A lot of the time, you know, you've got to allow someone, they might, but that was too scary for that person. So it's about teaching someone how to be a therapist, not just how to do hypnosis, you know.
And I'm assuming it's a continuous process of learning. You know, you don't just get your diploma and then that's the end of it. So do you then work with people that you train on a kind of an ongoing basis after that to just kind of as a sounding board or as a, this is what's coming down the pipe you might be interested in, or?
Yeah. And again, where we're going more into the mainstream, we have a requirement to do continuous professional development, as a lot of other therapists and associated workers would, and also supervision, which is, someone asked, it's an odd word, supervision. In therapy terms, it means you have someone to, like a mentor and someone who is further down the line than you, who can, it's designed to keep your client safe and you safe and drive the industry and your learning forward. So it's a quality control as well as kind of a mentoring and coaching process as well. So it's a really useful process. And yes, somebody should be in supervision. I'm in supervision. Mm-hmm. I'm gaining my qualification in it at the moment. That's my progression. That's the next point along for me, was other than teaching, was also gaining, a formal qualification that's externally verified in supervision. And I always say to people, you know, as soon as when you're qualified, it's like the bit like learning to drive. It's like when you've passed your test, that's the start of it. Mm. You know, you never stop. I mean, I learn things every day. Mm. And again, I think the more and the way that we work, because it's based around how the brain works, you'll find all of us will be looking at, you know, what's going on in neuroscience. You know, it's not unusual for us to be sharing stuff from The New Scientist and things like that. It's not fluffy. It's very, you know, people say, I'm not sure if I believe in hypnotherapy. And I just, you know, depending on how cheeky I'm feeling, if I can get away with it, it's like, you don't have to believe. Science doesn't care if you believe it or not, in it or not. You know, it keeps on sciencing.
I watched a really fascinating programme the other week. It was about dyslexia. It was about a BBC journalist or cameraman, I think, whose son was dyslexic, and they were following him through a school year, an exam year, and the difficulties that he was encountering in life. But the really interesting point about the programme was that actually they're now starting, the scientists and neuroscientists are starting to think about dyslexia and autism in terms of how we have had to evolve as a species in order to find solutions to problems. And so people that are dyslexic, for example, they think in a completely different way. You know, they're much more creative in terms of their thought process. And actually, you know, I found that fascinating. And rather than, you know, kind of labelling them as dyslexic and therefore, you know, problematic, you know, in a school environment, being taught in a traditional way, what we should actually be doing is embracing, you know, people with dyslexia or autism, for example, because of the value that they can add to society in terms of new thinking and fresh thinking. And, you know, historically, I guess what I'm getting at is, you know, we would have prescribed a pill for something, or, you know, we would have operated on someone because they've snapped their Achilles tendon or whatever it is, which is fine. But actually, there's a whole new way of thinking now that's beginning to emerge, which is everything that you're talking about, which is fascinating, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think it is. It's that, you know, this is a, you know, a syndrome or a disorder. Mm. And it's like, or is it just
a condition?
A condition. Mm. And is it, or is it just, you know, and that's why I love the phrase neurodiversity, mm. which is such a nice way of describing it, and actually more appropriate. Mm. I always used to joke with a friend of mine, her daughter, you know, she had all the labels under the sun and went to a special school because she was autistic, but in a very specific way, mm. and had a really extensive diagnosis. And I just went, mate, you're an X-Man. Mm. That's actually exactly. you're the next level. Yes. We're the old guard. Mm. Actually, I think you're the next phase. Mm. And if you look at who's amazing, Greta Thunberg, is it?
Yes, the girl that's just absolutely. Sailed across to
just
New
sailed
York.
Across. Mm. And if you
climate
watch her,
change. Mm.
She just doesn't get because they were trying to kind of cut her down because they said, oh, she's, you know, she's autistic. Mm. And it's like, yeah, she goes, and yes, that means I don't get distracted. Mm. You know, I keep going. And boy, does she. I mean, she is amazing. Mm. Mm. And you think of it like that, and you think of all the other, if you look at all the people, you know, who are dyslexic, and actually if you run through the people who you think are amazing, mm. how many of them said, actually, yeah, I am noticed on the autistic
like
spectrum. Mm,
yeah.
Or,
well,
yes,
Richard
I've had
Branson
dyslexic.
Is, you know, well known as a dyslexic.
Absolutely.
And, you know, so,
yeah.
Yeah, no, it's just amazing that it's taken us so long to get to the point where we're now starting to embrace and understand and investigate and, you know, make use of people like you, for example, to actually, you know, help us kind of move ahead rather than, you know, being labelled, you know, as a kind of a no hope and stuck in an institution or whatever, you know, or a special needs school,
Or given a lifelong supply of pills and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, but then that's where we have neuroscience to thank, because where, you know, people used to think, you know, how your brain is how your brain is forever and ever. And now they know that you can carry on changing your brain circuitry up until you've not breathing anymore. Mm. It may slow down and change in a little ways, but actually the lovely phrase is, you know, plasticine, not porcelain. Mm. And if you think of it in that way, it's like, you know, it's not, oh, this is just who I am. Mm. That is not 100% relevant anymore. It's like, no, that's how you are, but that doesn't need to be who you are.
No, that's a really
can be
point.
Changed.
Mm. Absolutely.
Mm. So I think, yes, it's now massaging the brain as opposed to lopping out chunks of it and throwing it away like they used to in the Victorian times.
Absolutely.
The good old-fashioned lobotomy,
yeah,
was
that's it?
You know,
frontal lobotomies,
take
yeah.
a chunk out and don't need that bit anymore.
Yeah, probably not.
Good. Fabulous. So so where do we kind of go from here? I mean, what's exciting and new that you're kind of working on, and or can you not tell us, or
it's top secret. No, it's not top secret. I'd like everyone to know. As I said, you know, people say, is there enough, you know, is there enough kind of work for people? And I'm like, yes,
right.
Trust me, there is. Then you need, I couldn't train enough people. The reason I got into it is because I can't do enough. Mm. But I can train other people to do it, and I can train other people to, you know, be in practice and support them and motivate them to stay in practice. So,
and I think the demand's increasing as well.
Absolutely.
Isn't it? Because it just, things are changing. People seem under more pressure, especially the, I don't know, 25 to 40-year-old bracket, I think, just seem to be going through
hell. Well, mental
health,
you mentioned earlier, is becoming the kind of big one.
It's more out there, isn't
obesity is, you know, certainly is kind of a big thing, if you pardon the pun. But Mental health.
I'm not sure I can.
Mental health, I know, is the kind of is something people talk about a lot, particularly in the workplace today, and stress and what have you. But I don't think anybody quite understands it.
But is it the case that in today's world we're becoming less fearful of talking about it? Is it, you know, you talk about it seems to be an ever increasing amount of mental health issues. Well, are there an ever increasing amount, or are we just becoming more aware because we're more open to talk about them?
I think it's some and some. I think if you look at the way things are designed, and we've said we were going to keep a very positive show, so I'm not going to go in the way the country's run that's actually designed to make everyone mentally ill. So we'll just draw a little full stop there.
But we'll move on.
Yeah, don't want to kind of unleash that beast. No time for that soapbox. It's twofold, David. You're absolutely right. There is an element of, yes, we are talking about it more. I think there is, the more uncertain circumstances are, the more we're likely to have mental health challenges. It is twofold. The joy is that it is, you know, it's like the health and safety executive, the eye of Sauron has gone onto mental health, and so it should, because I've had clients who...
Are you a big Lord of the Rings fan? Is that where that came from? Just for everybody that didn't quite get that kind of...
It's a really good, it's a great metaphor. fabulous metaphor.
A sound analogy indeed, Whitey.
Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of, it's gone from, we've stopped people falling off ladders and things quite so much in building sites. So actually they've taken it into mental health because they know that actually people were discriminated against hugely, and nobody knew what to do either, so they couldn't, even if a company wanted to help, they didn't have any training to do it either. So that's kind of one of the things that I work for another company, mental health in the workplace, and I do mental health awareness training.
That's a really good point.
Yeah, you must get called in a lot and stuff like that.
It's starting. I mean, the more forward thinking are going, and the more kind of things like councils and like healthcare trusts and things like that have already started because they know they need to. We do have some really nice private clients who are just absolutely, they're like, yeah, actually we should know about this stuff. Please do come in, because it just means that you know what to do. And there is the heart, and because the shadow side of that is because people are going, oh, is mental health going to be the new bad back? Well, only if you leave it in that way. Yes. If you train people around it, then actually they know what to look for, so they know the difference between somebody who's genuinely struggling and which is much more likely than someone kind of chancing their arm.
Yeah.
There's much more likelihood that someone's genuinely struggling.
Yeah. I mean, if I think back to my sort of corporate days, and Dave, I'm sure you'll back me up on this as well, but the only time I ever saw the HR director wherever I worked is I was either getting fired or hired. You know, there was nothing in between sort of thing, you know. So sort of 5 years have passed and I've never actually had a conversation with you about how do you feel about work? You know, what do you think we could do better in the workplace?
Or, are you coping?
Yeah. Are you coping all right? You know, have you got too much work on? You know, are you busy enough? You know, no kind of conversation at all. I mean, you have your kind of your annual assessment with your line manager, you know, and then
your appraisal.
Yeah. And then you go away with your kind of your 3% pay rise or whatever. And that's kind of about
those were the days.
That's about the limit of it, isn't it? But actually, there's an awful lot of people who are quite lonely at work, I think, because they've got no one to talk to on that level.
I think if we look back at the days, you know, you and I, Martin, certainly can look back at corporate days, just how much opportunity has been missed purely because the workplace didn't know how to deal with these things, didn't know how to recognise these things, didn't know how to work with people who might have had autism or dyslexia or some kind of condition that could be helped and could be worked with. How much has been lost? To me, that's the exciting thing about what you do, Ali. Now it's, you know, we've got now opportunity now to actually do things, go much, much, much better than we ever could before.
Definitely. And it is the direction we're going. You know, why not make use of a skill set? It's ridiculous, isn't it? You know, you're going, any business is going to have to be faster, more agile, more creative, well, go for the people who can do that.
Yeah, you know,
and find a way to bring them in and find a way to look after them when you've got them. So that's, you know, that is a side of it that I do love doing that training simply because it means that people aren't going to fall out of work. Because, of course, having a meaningful, you know, and being able to support yourself is a part, great bit of what keeps your mental health well. So to have that place as a boost to your mental health. Imagine working somewhere where your mental health is improved by working there. I mean, that's a concept, isn't it?
Yeah, that would be ideal, wouldn't it? It's interesting, Martin, because you touched on something just now about in the PLC world with the HR guy, and there may be being a bit of loneliness in some situations. And I think that's actually more so now with the rise in self-employment and stuff like that. So there's so many people that are kind of working at home, starting off at home or in their garden shed or doing something in their office, and they're looking at four walls and they don't interact with anybody. They might make a few phone calls, but they're probably doing emails and social media, and they don't actually kind of talk to anybody anymore. And it's interesting that at BBM, when my kind of networking members, if you like, come and talk to me, and a lot of them say lots of good things that, you know, how they've helped people and how much business they get from it and how much they enjoy it and stuff like that. But I still do get quite a lot of people say, I absolutely love to come because it's the only time I actually really see anybody and kind of interact with people. And that's a really interesting point, isn't it? That if you kind of don't do stuff like that, you're almost cutting yourself off from conversation, lots of other people.
Conversation
and interaction and sort of, you know, just patting people on the back and all that stuff that you don't get because you're just stuck in four walls all day. Scary thought, isn't it? So,
well, and considering half the workforce in the UK is effectively self-employed, you know, that's
and
a big
increasing
number, isn't it?
Mm.
So, yeah, so you are going to be very busy. Busier.
Definitely.
And busier.
Yes.
As time moves on. And I look forward to seeing your first practice opening in a local GP surgery, maybe in Folkestone or even Ashford.
That would be fabulous.
As time goes by.
It's happening elsewhere, in Bristol, Birmingham.
Yeah.
We've got graduates that are working in GP, in health centres usually.
Yeah.
So, but they've got space there and the GPs kind of side along the corridor and go, what's all this then?
Yeah.
And we show them the data and they get very excited.
Yeah. I'm all for it.
Yeah.
Sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
Good. Not before time, by the sounds of it.
Yeah.
Ali, how can somebody listening in who is interested to find out more about perhaps making a career out of clinical hypnotherapy, how can they get in touch with you to kind of pick your brains, as it were?
So, depending on where you are, and if it's for Kent, it's literally, it's just cphtkent.co.uk, or you can come and find me on Facebook,
Twitter.
Not Twitter.
You are on Twitter.
I know, but I don't like it. So do you have to like it?
You don't have to like it.
No.
Yes, but I won't respond.
Oh, okay.
There's no point. Okay. But I would say to people, feel free to stalk me personally as Ali Hollands,
right?
Because I make sure it's all there.
Yes.
But it is CPHT, and if you just want to look at the whole of the UK, it's cphd.co.uk. But if you're in Kent, it's Kent. If you live in Essex, because that's where the Essex and St Albans are where I'm opening the next centres that we do, it's Essex CPHT, Essex CPHT St Albans.
CPHT is the key.
Yes,
brilliant, fantastic. I think that's everything for now. I think from Ali. I think we'll definitely need to get you back on the show when you're up and running somewhere on that basis within a kind of a more traditional GP type environment. That's going to be fascinating.
It's got to be Maidstone first, I think.
I don't doubt I will be sending one of my ex-students your way because they've got in there. I love where I am, but one of them will be.
Yeah.
In the next year, I reckon.
What are you saying about Maidstone
then? Just because it's my town, Dave. County town of Kent. I like it all happening around Maidstone.
Brilliant. Well, for now, Ali, thank you so much for coming on the show. You've been superb. People can catch up, as I say, from tomorrow on our kind of episode section on the website. But for now, thank you, Ali Hollins.
Well done, Ali.
Thank you very much.
Brian.
Martin.
I think what we need to do is play a bit more tunage by way of an introduction to our next guest.
Yes. Guess the link to Dave the Rave.
Guess the link. So that's what we're going to do. So we will see you on the other side of this.
On the side.
You're listening to Kent Biz Connect. Tweet us live at Kent_Biz.
an absolutely fabulously cheesy song that was.
Yeah, isn't it? I thought we were going for the full 12-inch version there for a minute.
Do you know what? I'm cringing. I'm just thinking of the words that you use, Martin. Dave and rave in the same sentence. There,
Dave the rave. Oh. That's now your street name, Dave.
Brian.
So do you know who that was?
Tell us more. I don't.
Yeah,
no.
there's a bit of tenuous linkage, basically, because that was Dance Yourself Dizzy by a group called Liquid Gold that didn't have a long stream of hits. In fact, that was the only one.
That was it.
But nevertheless, it was a classic, and it's very, very popular at weddings. It was one of the most popular dance records at weddings.
And that's the clue, isn't it?
And that's the kind of link. Because
with us is the brilliant Dave DiCara.
There we go.
Toastmaster and Master of Ceremonies.
Absolutely. So he's done a few weddings, haven't you, Dave?
I've done a few in your time.
There's a lot more to him than that, so that's what we're going to find out.
Dave, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I know you've had, as always, a fabulously busy wedding season. So why don't you kick us off and tell us a little bit more about what you actually do in a kind of a wedding event context?
Well, okay. So think about a wedding. Think about turning up to an event of any sort. Think about, you don't know people there particularly, you're not sure where you're going, you're walking through the door, and what an awful lot of people do, they start to look around, they start to think, where am I supposed to be? What am I supposed to be doing? Do I go over here? Do I go over there? And almost as soon as you arrive at an event, that's where using somebody like a Toastmaster, Master of Ceremonies, Toastmaster is a form of Master of Ceremonies, using somebody like myself actually really starts to bring some value. Because we're there to make sure that that sort of situation doesn't happen. We're there to... taking charge is an expression that gets used, but it's not one that I like at all. We're there to guide and make people aware of what's going on and communicate with them.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably the key word when you're talking about Toastmaster. Even at weddings, where you think everybody's there to have fun, get on the dance floor and boogie down, keyword all the way through the day and the evening is communicate.
Yeah, because without someone like you, I'm just trying to think of some of the weddings that I've been to, and I don't go to that many. That's the sad thing about weddings. They don't come up that often, do they? But if in the absence of someone like you, does tell people it's time for drinks or it's time to sit down for dinner or now we're going to have the speeches, or who normally does that job? Is it the kind of the father of the bride, or who steps in and does that job?
No, most commonly at a wedding, if there isn't a Toastmaster there, somebody like the father of the bride or somebody like the best man will make announcements and will introduce speakers, introduce the speeches.
Mm.
The kind of role that you've described is one that would usually be taken by a member of staff of the venue.
Right.
And there you're in very much in the hands of who it is, who it is. And you've touched on something there, because one of the questions that comes up, and I'm often presented with, is, do I need a Toastmaster?
Yeah.
And the honest answer, and the one that I give immediately, is no, you don't.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need a Toastmaster. There's always another way of dealing with it.
Yeah.
But the question that I suggest you should be asking is, how much better would it be if I did have a Toastmaster?
Right.
So bringing in a professional who actually earns their living by doing what we do.
Okay. So just describe a typical day for you then as a Toastmaster at a wedding.
It can vary quite considerably, but if I take what is the most common course of events, there'll be a ceremony. These days, ceremonies are very, very often held in the same place as the venue that's going to hold the wedding reception.
Mm-hmm.
It's not exclusively like that. There are, churches are still used, registry offices are still used, but the vast majority of cases, it's the ceremony and the reception are all in the same venue. Guests will arrive. The bridegroom will be there. My role, I'd like to arrive about an hour before the ceremony.
Right.
I'll get there earlier if there are things that I'm going to be doing, if I'm going to have a much closer involvement with what the bride in particular is doing, then I'll get there much earlier than that. But that's one of those things that gets brought up when I have a full briefing meeting with the wedding couple.
Okay, so that's important. So so let's backtrack a little bit. The starting process is you to meet the couple that are getting married.
Very much.
So that you understand what their day is actually going to look like.
Very much indeed. Mm. And very often they're not quite sure.
Right.
So part of my role is to make them aware of what the options are going to be.
Okay.
If we go back a lot of years, one could be almost dictatorial about it. Mm. You as a wedding couple, you would come along and you'd meet a Toastmaster and you'd be asking the Toastmaster, and it would almost exclusively, years gone by, would have been a he. You'd say, what do we do? And he would tell you what you are going to do in
right.
what order.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't your day. It was kind of, it was his day in many ways.
Well, yes, historically, because couples didn't actually know
right.
what the options were, what Gosh. Could be done.
Mm-hmm.
In today's world, we've got a very different situation.
Mm.
And now it's very much a case of, as a Toastmaster, what I want to know is, how do you want your day to go?
Right.
You are the ones that are getting married.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about the way that you would like the day to be run.
Yeah.
What are the key things that you want to have happen and when?
Mm-hmm.
What would you like? Now, certainly I can come along and I can say, well, you know what, traditionally, this, that or the other has
right.
always been done.
Mm-hmm.
But it's your wedding, so
yes.
why not start the tradition with your wedding?
Yeah.
I had to laugh recently. I was speaking with a couple and we were talking about when things go wrong.
Mm.
And one of the things, okay, I'm a Toastmaster. Ali, you work in the professional field, yes?
Mm.
We have other professionals looking at what we are doing.
Mm.
All right. So I'm thinking of one particular wedding couple where the bridegroom is standing on the wrong side of his bride. At the wedding table, he's sitting at the wrong side of his bride.
Okay. Gosh, I wouldn't even know what that is.
Well, here you go. You see, other professionals sitting out there will see the pictures and they'll come and say, the Toastmaster didn't
what
get
a
him
cock
on the right.
up. What, yeah.
You know, yeah, what a mess. What a mess. The realities are that on this particular example, when I met them, I talked about what's traditionally done, positioned him on the right side, in inverted commas, and he said, I don't like being here.
Mm.
I'm going to do it the other way around.
Oh, right. I was going to ask you, yeah. Does it matter?
Mm. No, it doesn't matter at all.
Mm.
I mean, you can go into the historic reasons and the myths and the legends as to why you did this, that, or the other. But once again, this is the beautiful thing about living in today's world and the work that we do as a Toastmaster.
Yeah.
We can advise.
Right.
We can guide. We do not dictate.
No. So when it comes to the formality of a wedding, and a lot of weddings still are quite formal, aren't they, in terms of the kind of, you know, how they run during the day, the flow of it and everything else. You know, it's this, then it's that, then it's speeches, you know, then it's whatever, dancing and what have you. But so on that side of things, you've obviously, you're a world of information in terms of, well, you know, this is what the traditional kind of script looks like. But then you can just tailor that and bespoke it.
Absolutely, and it's a very, very good starting point.
Because you wouldn't want to miss anything out, would you? I mean, I wouldn't, you know, if I wouldn't want to miss out the speeches, for example, because I hadn't, you know, spoken to somebody like
I've
you.
Been to a fair few weddings
and planned them
had.
In, and then at the end of the night you think, oh, God, we didn't, you know, we didn't do the speeches, you know, or whatever, so.
No, really
or toasting, you know, when you do the toasting, because that's incredibly important, isn't it? You have to recognise, you know, the mother of the bride and the, you know, there's certain people that need to be, and you often talk about the mother of the bride being your, is she your fiercest critic or the most important person in the room you talk about?
Oh, now I'm on dangerous ground. mothers of the brides, you are not dragons, okay? You are not dragons. There's a pregnant pause there. I'm just thinking, what can I actually get away with? Mothers of the bride, there is this caricature of the mother of the bride. Mm. I have to say that in my experience as a professional, mothers of the brides have been absolutely fabulous in the way that they've acted at weddings and in the way that I've been able to interact with them. They've been absolutely wonderful and very helpful and cooperative. You talked about the formality.
Mm.
Think rather than think about formality, think about structure.
Mm, structure.
You've run business events.
Flow.
Brian, you've run business events as well. Ali, you've been to many, many events. You run training courses. There is such a fine line between casual and chaos. And having at a wedding, a Toastmaster, at another event, perhaps a Master of Ceremonies, can actually make sure that you stay the right side of that. So at a wedding, do we want to be formal? Well, you know, trust me, you want formality. Oh, boy, I can bring it. I'm old enough to do that.
But
do we want it? You know, what we want really a wedding is smiles.
Yeah.
And you don't get smiles by getting every technical detail correct in the way that somebody thinks it ought to be correct. Yes. You get smiles by people feeling happy.
Yeah.
Brian, you mentioned the word flow just now. By making the event flow so you don't have hiccups, so that it seems as though everything is happening and it's working very nicely and it's not something that I should be worried about.
Yeah, no, I like that. So it's sort of like a comfy pair of slippers sort of approach, rather than stilettos or a pair of brogues that are just a bit too tight and uncomfortable.
I'm trying to get my head around stilettos and comfy slippers.
The sad thing is, I totally understand what he means. Yeah. So,
no, I buy into that.
Here's the point. Mm-hmm. When we're working at a wedding, stuff has to happen.
Mm.
There are times when people actually do need to move from here to there. Mm. People do need to be seated, for example, for the beginning of the ceremony.
Of course.
People do have to be present for some of the photographs that the bride and groom have asked for. Mm. When it comes to sitting down at the wedding breakfast, particularly if you've got hot food, you know what, there's a time for service, and that's done for a reason.
Yes.
The whole kitchen is prepared to start service at that particular time. Mm. So there are...
And in fact, when you watch a lot of these reality shows, there's a reality show, I think they were focusing in on weddings at kind of various chateaux in France, and how a lot of, you know, expats have set up bought these huge places and kind of set them up as wedding venues, because obviously, you know, there's an awful lot of money in weddings these days. I've forgotten my train of thought, what we were talking about there. Oh yes, but the biggest problem they have is, you know, that there's fireworks at midnight. They have to get them in because they've only got permission, you know, a license between, you know, midnight and 12:15 or whatever. All the locals will be up in arms, but they're still eating their meal, and you know, they're having to try and shepherd people out of sort of, you know, and get them to finish their meal to get out onto the veranda to see the fireworks before they're not allowed to have the fireworks anymore because they've only got a license between. And they, again, that's because people haven't been shepherded to the right place at the right time, and
shifting 400 really drunk people around is incredibly easy. Of course,
it's often there's a wonderful phrase. Being a Toastmaster is like it's like shepherding cats.
Mm.
Only cats are rather more cooperative. But okay, we can laugh about that. But what you might find rather strange, you talk about drunken people. I did a wedding where the groomsmen, there are six of them in all, I mean, they were well plastered before the ceremony even started. And you know, you're looking to use the groomsmen to be doing things as well. And I thought, oh my God, this isn't going to work well.
Mm.
Do you know what? Those guys were absolutely brilliant. Mm. Plastered or not, they absolutely stepped up and did the job and were shepherding people around and were fetching people, members of the family that were needed for things. Mm. I absolutely couldn't fault the way that they were helping me. And that's a big thing about being a Toastmaster. You're not a prima donna.
No.
We're part of a team of people.
Right.
That are working together to make a fantastic day for the wedding couple.
Right.
And that team of people can involve guests as well, like the groomsmen.
Mm.
It will certainly involve the caterers, the musicians, the photographers, anybody else there that's on the wedding supplier list. We're all working together to make that day fantastic. Mm. And when we do work together, it's absolutely magic.
Mm.
Toastmasters there, typically we have the loud voice when it's needed.
Mm.
We're wearing the bright coloured jacket.
Mm.
We're very, very visible. But there's an awful lot that's going on behind.
So behind the scenes, you're a bit of a sort of a regimental sergeant major in many ways, aren't you? I bet you're not afraid to get in there and mix it up with the caterers and the, you know, the band or whoever, just to make sure that it all works on the day.
The proverbial duck, aren't you, Dave? Well, it's all serene and tranquil on the surface and underneath that water.
Underneath, yes, there's an awful lot going on. But trust me, you get an awful lot more done by being nice and asking for help
than
trying to tell people to do.
Yeah.
That really gets people's backs up and really doesn't work. It creates an unpleasant atmosphere. It's not somewhere we want to go.
Create a situation you perhaps
you just don't need to.
But I can see the advantage of working with somebody like you, because for me, I mean, when I got married, I was nervous as hell. I mean, I'm not afraid to admit it. I really was nervous. I mean, I've never been so nervous. But, you know, to have somebody like you that I could lean on and know you're going to sort it on the day would just take so much of that angst away. I mean, I didn't have a Toastmaster, but it would have helped enormously, I think, because I was having to think about so much detail on the day. And actually, it meant that I was almost kind of separated from the actual event itself, though I was the guy getting married.
This is the big, big thing, the point that we make to a wedding couple. Please, if you're going to use me, the idea is you don't have to worry.
Yeah.
You don't wear a watch unless you want it as a piece of jewellery.
Yeah.
You're not worrying about where people are, who's there, who's not there, where are people supposed to be.
Mm.
That's my job.
I'm
we'll have had the briefing meeting with yourself at the venue, with the venue coordinator as well.
Mm.
We've all got the running order. Mm. It's over for me to work with the venue now to make that running order to happen. And it's funny, Ali, as you were speaking, you mentioned three words. You mentioned therapy, relaxation, stress relief. And I actually wrote them down because, oh my God, Martin, the situation that you've just described, you needed some therapy way back then. It's about helping people relax. And just removing that stress.
Yeah.
And it's not just about the bride and groom. We have to pay attention to the guests as well.
Yes.
Because if the guests arrive and they know what's going on, and as a Toastmaster you're able to engage with them in a friendly way, sometimes with a bit of banter. And trust me, sometimes that banter does get very, very rude. But it can be great, great fun.
It's a whole room, isn't it? So we're talking specifically there about weddings. I've been to various business events and exhibitions and things like that, and I'm listening to the next seminar. Is in 10 minutes time and the speaker will be, and quite often it's been you doing that announcing. So moving it on to a business point of view, then you clearly do lots of business events, conferences, exhibitions, seminars.
Absolutely. I've been the exhibition announcer quite a few times at exhibitions. I've also done business conferences. I've hosted networking meetings where there's been need, or I don't like using that word need, but there's been a recognition of the value of having somebody external coming in and actually introducing the key players, the key people. I attended as a guest a function in London a couple of years ago where there was one, His Excellency, there are a couple of their lordships and other good and glorious, and a dame of the realm got up to speak onto the stage. She was 5 minutes talking before the room went quiet and people realised that she was up there. I wasn't working. I'm in civvies. I desperately wanted to go up and just stop her, call the room to order, introduce her properly. And this is the thing, when we get into a business event, Brian, it's so important for impact. We want you, when you guys are going to get up and speak, we want the room ready and waiting. So the introduction wants to be there, the calling to order, the quiet, then the introduction, and then it's over to you.
And it's not always easy, is it? I mean, as we all know, including you three, even at a BBN networking meeting, it's not easy to kind of get 50-odd people to stop drinking coffee, to sit down immediately and be quiet so that you can actually start the meeting.
Well, Brian, in that case, usually it's because we're deliberately trying to wind you up.
It is fun to watch, right? Watching Brian try and get us to all sit down. Just wander off in the wrong direction. It'll be hilarious.
All of us are studiously ignoring him, and he thinks we can't hear.
But that's a really good point. Just the start of an event like that, you know, calling the event to order, I think is a really good phrase, isn't it? I mean, you've run an event for me in the past that we did down at Discovery Park with East Kent College. We did it in conjunction with them. And, you know, again, that just took the pressure off me immediately because it was Dave who was calling the room to order, not me, you know, because, you know, you have a certain way of doing it.
I did an award ceremony once where they had a celebrity who was going to be the host for the evening and was going to do all of the talking and all of the introductions. And they had this event the previous year. They'd spoken to me about being a Toastmaster, and they said, no, we don't need... We've decided we don't need one because the celebrity is going to do that job. They came back to me the following year and said, actually, we're going to have a Toastmaster to do some of the logistical work. And that was very much doing that kind of thing. Then introducing the host. So I had the wonderful opportunity of introducing a celebrity speaker onto the stage who took over as the host. And then I was involved in a couple of other logistical things.
Transition stuff.
Absolutely. And it worked very, very well indeed. So the business events... My next gig is actually going to be a degree convocation in the House of Commons.
Right. Which I was going to say, you do a fair bit up there, don't you, at the
I've done a House few of things. Parliament. I've done a few things there, yes. It's it's very, very nice very nice to work
there.
My smallest changing room ever was in the House of Commons.
Oh, right.
Phone box again.
Yeah, it was a cubicle in the gents' toilets. Trust me. You tell me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Incredibly small, but great fun. And there... You're wanting to bring a sense of purpose, a sense of style,
gravitas.
Absolutely, the gravitas has got to be there. And you, in that case, you are wanting to bring in some formality.
Yes,
but you know, even in that kind of circumstance, it's helpful and it's nice to bring along a smile as well. You still you do want people to be smiling, but always remember, we as Toastmasters, we don't propose the toasts. That shocks a lot of people.
Right.
We're called the Toastmasters, but no, we don't propose. We introduce the people who are going to be the speakers. We introduce the people who are going to propose the toasts, the people who are going to make the speeches. We are not the act. We're introducing the act. So I'm not a comic, but I can bring a lighter touch to the way that we're getting everybody together.
Yeah.
But then it's over to the speakers to actually be... doing their job.
But it's good to compartmentalize events and weddings in that way as well, isn't it? So that, you know, everything has a sort of a time and a place, as it were, you know, and it's important to think about it in that way. Otherwise, a lot of it is just left to chance, isn't it, I guess?
That's what we don't want to have happen. Yeah, we have to be able to think on our feet because, you know, like the typical battle plan, it doesn't survive the first bullet. Okay. Same thing goes for a wedding or a business conference or a gala dinner, an awards ceremony. You go out, you've got a structure. You've done the research, you've had the discussions, you've got a running order, but then you have to be able to adapt and change. Martin, you described a situation where you're still sitting down to dinner and the fireworks have got to happen.
Yes.
You know, these things can happen for reasons which just crop up on the day. You can't actually change
the oven wasn't working.
Well, there you go.
So the partridge is late or whatever.
You've got it. So then
you're
we have
still in a pear tree.
What can we change around? And that's where the teamwork issue becomes very, very important.
Yeah.
Because if you're working it as a team, everybody's looking to make, make a good result.
So being able to think on your feet, and you would know that, and therefore you can go to the bride and groom or whoever and say, can we just change the order of things slightly because the food is going to be late? Could we perhaps do the, you know, the fireworks now before we sit down to dinner?
And do you know what? I've been professional for 5 years now. I have yet to work with anybody that has said no. And there's been plenty of opportunity, plenty of times where we have had to make quite considerable changes. You know, you ask people, explain what's going on, and people understand. We're looking to work within a team to make the event, wedding, gala dinner, award ceremony, birthday party, whatever, we're looking to make it fantastic.
Yeah. And take that weight of responsibility for making it happen on the day away from you so that you can actually enjoy it.
That's it.
That's the key thing.
Important.
Yeah. That's invaluable.
Really. And in business.
Because it's your day.
Environment. Make sure your guests and delegates, et cetera.
Exactly. So you're there to network with them rather than worry about, you know, what happens next.
If they've run out of tea or coffee.
Dave will
something.
Tell you what's going to happen next. Yeah. Don't you worry about
that. That's the idea. Yeah. That's the idea.
Dave, we haven't even got on to the fact that your family are from Sicily. You know, and therefore nobody's ever going to mess with you anyway, purely on that basis. We'll get into that another time.
Yes.